Hey, good morning, everyone. Welcome to Saturday Morning Tech. My name is Todd Cochran, and I've got Andy McCaskey from RVNN.tv up on top, and we have Rob Greenlee on the bottom. Good morning. How are you guys?
Doing well.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you, it's been a while since we had you on, Andy, so kind of start with you first. How are things going, and what you been up to?
Well, just continue working on the... try and build a network here at RVNN-TV and making some changes to our shows. Really kind of surprised at the amount of mobile activity that we're seeing, and that's really encouraging. But trying to shorten up shows, make them a little more amenable to that sort of viewership.
Well, it's I know that you've been working with the format quite a bit, and it's a lot of development in the online space. We'll talk about some of that today, especially for network space. So, Rob, good morning. How are you? How's things in up in hopefully sunny Seattle this morning?
It's a little cloudy up here. It's not as sunny as it has been, but supposedly it's supposed to be sunny this weekend here. So I've got my fingers crossed because I'm planning on doing a real high-tech project this week to build a greenhouse in my backyard.
Building a greenhouse. Well, I've been building here too, so we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. But yeah. Everyone that's tuning in, you can definitely check all the shows out here at Geek News Central at geeknewscentral.com. If you've got comments on today's show, we want you to email us at geeknews@gmail.com and follow me at Twitter on at Geek News is the website. But I suppose you guys saw my blog post from last night.
I did.
So what do you think? And let me put this up on the website here. What do you guys think of my new creation? I'm defining the HDMBS, the High Definition Mobile Broadcast System.
Geek power all the way.
Trademark registration pending.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Patent pending, right?
Yeah. Well, it you got to call it something. So, this thing has been in my brain for 2 years on what to build, and the pieces really didn't come together until really NAB. And I wanted to talk about it just a little bit. You know, last year I bought the first piece to this. I bought the Blackmagic Design ATEM television studio, and I got it home and played with it, and I was it didn't do what I wanted to do. It was missing the H.264 recording, and quite frankly I was frustrated that it didn't deliver with that. And so what did I do? I just put it on the shelf. I went back to NAB this year, and I basically grabbed the BMD guys by the throat, and I said, "What did you do? You promised me this feature, and you never delivered." He says, "Well, I guess you haven't updated your device because we fixed that in November." And I was like, "Oh, did you not send out an email saying that there was an update?" No, we did not. And I'm like, "Well, that thing's been collecting dust on my shelf." And he kind of looked at me kind of funny, and I said, yeah, people won't use something if it misses a specific feature. So what I did, and it's really not that complicated, but it's just a sweet cherry design. It's using a couple of BMD monitors, and those are actually what they are, is their Smart View Dual. And a rack mountable, obviously. And then, of course, I've got below it the BMD ATEM television studio with the H.264 encoder. Then the device below that is a Behringer SRC2496. And the reason I had to have this box is on this first edition of the ATEM television studio, they made the audio in AES. which is fine, except for everything that I had didn't have an AES output. So I had to buy a analog to digital converter. And that's all that box does, is audio in, analog audio in, digital audio out, and that's what feeds the ATEM, so I can get audio into the box. So all these years I've been traveling with a Mackie mixer, and just, you know, doing the analog thing. So what I've done here is I bought one of these Motu 828 boxes. This was probably my biggest outlay of money on this system, because I had not planned on really buying that. But that basically provides the audio feed to the to everything. And I audio's critical. I wanted a good audio quality. And, you know, from top to bottom, it basically signal goes in the bottom and comes out the top. And one thing I like about these Black monitors is they've got an SDI in and an SDI out. So there's all kinds of opportunities. If I ever needed to have more video outs, I can just tap one from the monitor. But right now, what I do with the ATEM television is I feed a HDMI signal out into another Blackmagic design box, this Intensity Extreme, and then it converts that into Thunderbolt. And I just plugged it into the Thunderbolt port on my Mac. Now, what happens then is you can see from the picture, the Thunderbolt port is essentially tied to Wirecast. So I'm feeding Wirecast the video from the Intensity Extreme. Now, here's the cool part. The ATEM software control, it's basically software control of the switcher. And, you know, in the picture there, we only got one camera hooked up, but you can run up to four cameras on this thing, is that it comes in via, that is actually controlled via the network. It's got a network control. And then it connects also via USB to the Mac, and I can actually record if I wanted to, either on the Wirecast or on the ATEM software control. I'm going to do some experiments to see which is recording better. But I took this rig yesterday to an event here locally that I was paid to cover. I rolled in with the box, four cameras stuffed inside, along with some additional gear, because I needed to have longer runs for the cameras, and and I had basically my kid carry four tripods and one computer, one roll case, and four tripods, and I strung everything up. I had a stream, I'm not kidding you, from time I walked into the building to the time I had a stream up was less than about 20 minutes. And it sat there and hammered all day for 8 hours. And you want to see the best part? Didn't have an internet connection, but I had one of these. And you say, oh, what is this? This is a Cervero, C-E-R-E-V-O, Cervero Live Shell. And here's this thing even gets even more exciting. Now, this list is all on the Geek News Central article. Is I took my MiFi that I had purposely not used all month because I knew I was going to be doing this event. This connected to my MiFi via the Wi-Fi chip that's built in. And this actually has an HDMI in. So I took instead of feeding the Wirecast yesterday with this, the organizer had a commercial account on Ustream, so we pushed straight to Ustream with this. I'm showing it to you. Pushed to Ustream all day yesterday with this, and via my MiFi card. And all I used the Mac for was switching. I recorded on the Mac, but this little beauty has the ability to stick a micro SD card in it and actually record to it too. So we backup recorded to this at the same time we streamed through this. I'm like, ta-da, hallelujah. this is, Andy, you know where I've been heading for a long time.
Oh yeah.
This was amazing. And, potentially, if I get this thing where I figured out all the quirks on it, we don't need to take 30 boxes of shit to CES. We can roll this box in, plug it in, and be ready to go. Now, it's not as powerful as a TriCaster. You know, there's a lot of stuff it doesn't do. But I'm going to tell you, for, you know, this rig right there, as it's, well, not this, but as this sets in the on the desk, this box, $3,000 is what the total build out cost on that is. And
it's a lot less than a TriCaster.
Yes, it is. And it's four cameras. Now, you know, if you have a laptop already, you don't have to go out and buy a laptop. I don't need the, you know, I do audio recording too. So, you know, I didn't need this yesterday because we're doing strictly video. So really all you need is the Mac and the rig, and you can get away with, this is the minimal setup to do portable live streaming with four cameras. Now, what I did add, because some of the cameras were over 100 feet away, is I bought a mini converter optical devices, and basically I had fiber cable running basically we ran tape. My son, we had two big rolls of tape. We taped the fiber down in different places, and we ran fiber between the camera and this device. Now, you had to have two of those on each end. Well, thank God I only had to run two cameras long distance, but really the fiber roll, you know, how big's fiber? It's not big. It's not expensive. And so they worked out good. Now, I did have to use my SDI cameras with those. So I had two SDI cameras, a little higher end cameras, but I've been using these, you know, this is what I've primarily been using, are these Canon cameras, these consumer based. Well, this one's a little higher. This is the Vixia HFD G10. So I've been using these, HDMI out. It's just fantastic. So, you know, in my brain, it took a while to get this, you know, and the thing is, it's not complicated. This isn't something that anyone could have built, but now we'll have to see how it's going to travel. Is it going to survive? How is it going to survive airline rides? That's my biggest concern. We'll know in a year if it's completely broke, if it was a smart idea to build it this way. And I may end up at some point back in a Pelican case with this stuff, jury rig wired into it. But at this point, it's like this. Now, I could put it in a Pelican case and lay everything flat and run the wires in between the foam, and that may end up being potentially what I have to do. But not bad for a little portable system. Or this could be someone's home studio system too.
Yeah. So I had a couple of questions. When I had, and it's been over a year since I looked at the ADM, do they have the capacity to run lower thirds and the ability to have a DDR functionality? Not so much for recording the output, but for rolling clips as part of the program.
It's limited. You can load, you know, and it's clunky. So you can load some lower thirds. You have to be on your game. You have to pre-plan. This is nothing you can build on the fly. You can, but, you know, from a, you know, like the TriCaster, being able to reach over here and essentially not be looking. Of course, I'm cheating. I'm looking. But be able to bring up a lower third, you know, like this is not possible with this box. You have to be looking at the screen. You have to manipulate the menu to enact the lower third. But if you have someone running the switcher, no big deal, right?
Right. So it's kind of like Wirecast in that respect. That right. You can pre-build certain layers.
Yeah.
And then call them at that point.
Right. And I think the key here to it is that, you know, this thing has got some flexibility. I could have came up on Wirecast and been up all day on Wirecast and used that. But I didn't need to, my situation required a little different solution. Now, I could have connected my MiFi to my laptop too. But, you know, just because I wanted to prove that this thing would work. Now, this doesn't go into HD. This is not an HD device. It's SD. But I couldn't, you know, for a mobile situation, who cares?
Right, right.
You know, and it just it worked like a champ. Sit there all day and hammered away and didn't have a glitch. And You know, the true test would be running Wirecast for 2 or 3 hours and recording all that stuff. That'll be the true test. Now, the capture card on this using H.264 capture seems to be pretty good out of the ATEM as well. That's been my biggest complaint with Wirecast, is that I've never been real happy with the video capture on it. And so I think the only thing that I could think of buying potentially, for this, and this would be down the road because I've already exceeded my budget. Let me show you what I was thinking I'm going to potentially buy to add to this later. It's called the Thomas Samurai. And this is, they have an SDI and an HDMI version of this. And it's just a little recorder, and that you stick an SSD drive on the back of it, and it'll record as long as your SSD drive doesn't get filled out. And you feed an SDI signal to it. Now this is $1,500, so you know it's small enough that all I do is take a link off the program out. Take an SDI feed off the program out on the Blackmagic Design Monitor, and I've got myself a DDR right there that will record everything master. And I don't have to worry about software. And I think this is ultimately the best solution, but, I have to wait at this point before I buy this, replenish.
Yeah, that's a little expensive. Yeah.
Well, you know, and what it does, it's fantastic. You know, it's for $1,500. You can't go wrong. And I actually, you know, I've got, what's funny is I got a 120 gig SSD drive right here to go in it.
Oh, you're already set.
Well, it's one that I had gotten at a show, and I'm thinking, I knew what I'm going to use that SSD drive for. But Andy, you know, think about if we'd, you know, built this rig 2 or 3 years ago. You know,
I think the thing that is so interesting is when you look at this sort of capability from a fixed studio standpoint, and then if you go over to Podcasting News, Paolo Tosolini has a very interesting piece on the use of a iPhone 4S and a very basic lighting, variable light source. And then add some broadcast quality microphones, and these two pieces are like totally disruptive compared with what would have been required to cover trade show or event, even 3 years ago.
Is this the one that's a get better video from your iPhone or Android? Is that what you're talking about? Is that article?
It's get better video from your iPhone or Android smartphone. And it's, you know, just very basic stuff of trying to get your camera steady, improve the light source, and most importantly, make sure that you've got good, strong audio. Obviously, it's much better if you have a tripod in order to stabilize it and so forth, but that in combination with what you've created here is a reset.
And you know, just to think that I could load this in the back of my minivan, and you know, I could have done a one camera shoot with, you know, just walking in with a laptop bag and the box, an extension cord. You know, it was. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the thing to me that is just, you know, the guy. You know, it was a paid gig. And I had planned originally to have a car full of stuff, bringing a TriCaster, bringing all the gear, you know, 5 hours of setup. And matter of fact, I got a call from the guy about 3 hours before the event. He says, "Where are you at?" I said, "Oh, don't worry, I'm on schedule." Said, "Only take us about 30 minutes to set up. We're good." And the guy was incredulous because he had paid huge money the year before. And I will say he spent five figures the year before to pay a commercial firm to come in and do what I did for him for four figures. And, I probably could have charged him five. I just didn't know better. But I rolled in there with one box. The cameras were all stuffed inside, all the gear. I opened it up. Of course, you know, the box was pretty full. and he's kind of looking, you know. And I had all the wireless stuff. Basically, what I did is I put all the folks that were the actual talents that were going to be on air talents. They all had microphones with the plugged in transmitters, or they had lavaliers. And I wired the three people up that were going to be walking the event, and got the camera set up. And basically, he was just astounded. Now, what kind of scares me is, you know, he's like, I see him next to me writing stuff down. He's probably going to go out and buy his own rig.
Yeah. So you had three audio sources active?
I had what?
You had three active audio channels that you were mixing in the Motu?
Right. And basically what I would do is I would just pot them down when they weren't on. And so that was, you know, this Motu will take eight inputs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I just put them on a channel, and when they were ready to come on, I potted them up. And when I were, you know, it's not perfect, but this wasn't a fast moving event. It was, you know, kind of pre-orchestrated. I knew where people were going to be. So
what about primary power to your remote cameras and keeping batteries in the portable mics, et cetera?
I had extended life batteries in the, you know, the big ones in the Canons, and they run for 4 hours on a single set of batteries. And when we were getting down to an hour, I would just basically tell the guy, turn the camera off, change the battery out. And that's what he did. Now, we could have, you know, we ran completely off battery. Matter of fact, some of the devices that we were using, some of the Blackmagic design stuff was battery based. I was using converters that had AA batteries in them. They are called BMD battery converters. And let me bring up a picture of one of these. They're designed for sporting golf events, that kind of stuff. And so it's loading here. And basically, it's an HDMI to SDI converter. And you can run them anywhere. So these things work like absolute champ. And and they have a backup place where you can put a backup battery on them. Now, what I will probably do in the future is buy, you know, maybe a extended, basically they can be powered off USB. And basically the same type of thing as you use for the extended battery life on a telephone or a cell phone. So I just buy some of those battery packs, tape them to them, plug them in, turn them on. And, you know, I could get probably 8 hours of use out of one of these converters using a extended battery life. So it's not, you know, it depends on the situation on how you're going to wire it. But relatively inexpensive to fix some of the hard things.
Okay. So so you were not live. Were you actually live streaming but delayed?
That was live. It was live right there at the event. We were up live stream the whole time.
Okay. So so what was driving the shell? You were bringing HDMI content into the shell.
Right, into the shell. Mm-hmm. And it was,
and then, your backup was there and also on the Wirecast?
No, I didn't run Wirecast during the show. I just ran this.
Okay.
Yeah. Just ran this, and this went right to basically there's a little button on here. You press it and it starts the stream.
Wow. So
yeah.
Impressive.
Yeah. You just press
compare that with the broadcaster alternative of cut and paste.
Yeah. So it's not perfect, but you know, it in my MiFi held up. I was in the LTE zone. And I pulled up my bandwidth last night, and because we were pushing low, I only used, about 1.5 gigs of, and, you know, so it was fine.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah.
The total length of the event was what, Todd?
About 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we were live. Yeah, pretty much the whole time. I think 8 hours, but you know, the best part about this whole deal is I was tore down and out of there in like 20 minutes.
Oh yeah.
Walking out the door with this guy's check.
Hey Todd, you should sell him a kit. You know, he can own it, but then he can hire you to come in and run it.
Well, I've thought about building another one, just rent it.
Oh yeah, there you go. That's you know, an answer too.
But yeah. You know, you rent once or twice and then someone's gonna say, I can do this.
Yeah. Well, you're gonna have that problem either way, right?
Yeah. Well anyway, we've talked enough on this, but what do you guys think about the Revision 3 acquisition by Discover?
I kind of have mixed feelings about it. I mean, I think it's great for them. I'm really curious what it means for the web, web video content creator side of the fence. Does this mean that the big studios, the big TV networks are going to come in and snap up all of the web creators so they can tamp down on the competition that's brewing? Or is this just good that the big networks are starting to realize that web video is important and we have new competitors?
Well, it's interesting because my phone rang yesterday and a guy identified himself and he wanted to know all about Raw Voice and yeah. You know, and it has gotten the attention of a lot of people. And I think people are now, you know, so I wouldn't be surprised to see some other, some other companies get scooped up in this. Now, this guy wasn't he was looking for info. Let's put it that way. He wanted to know all about us and many just about any type of question you can, you know. I told him, I said, this stuff's all in the net. It's not, we have a closed book. And one thing I saw NAB was the appetite for talent. Now, I'm not saying people talent, the appetite for content with good talent is off the hook. I mean, every other place I went to, you know, they find out who I was, what I did, you know, how much talent do you have? How many shows? What can you sell me that would go into my IPTV device that we're launching? So there's a huge, huge, huge appetite for content and decent content. And I'm going to tell you, the bar is not very high.
Hmm. Interesting. So is this caller that you got, was it from a big network of some sort, or can you say?
It was a Silicon Valley group.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, Silicon Valley group. So, you know, and I told the guy, I said, get your checkbook out.
Get your checkbook out.
And, you know, he kind
of
laughed.
Lots of zeros. Lots of zeros, let's, right?
Get your checkbook out.
Well, I think it's really interesting. My understanding of the New York upfront ad sales, and by memory, I think that some of the major networks, NBC, ABC, and Fox, lost a substantial number of viewers just in the past 2 months, and they're trying to figure, you know, how much of that is nice weather where people are outside not watching TV as much, but. There are instabilities, I guess you'd say, in the system.
Yeah, I think people are distracted. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there right now.
Yeah.
You know, Friday.
There's a lot of choices. There's a lot of content choices out there and a lot of different ways to get it. And I think a lot of these big networks are getting kind of, you know, their audience is being so fragmented with other options that it's about time that those big content providers get with the ball game and start playing the game that the web creator has been playing for a long time.
Right.
You know,
and I got to throw a grenade here in the table. I've got $99, and where should I spend my $99?
For some of them, that's about the right analogy, I think. Right.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, $30 million for Rev 3 is a drop in the bucket to Discovery Channel, who is a $60 billion a year company.
I was actually a little disappointed in the price. I thought Rev could have got more.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like that's kind of a standard acquisition price for small startups is between the 20 and 35, maybe 40 million range. And that's about as, I mean, if you really think about back, you know, over like the last 5 or 6 years, that's about the standard buying price, right?
Yeah, you know, but they got a great talent pool. But also, you know, they're in the same situation we are. They don't own all those shows. They have contracts.
No, they don't.
They have contracts That's right. with those shows. So, you know, we and same with us. We don't own any shows, but we have. And I bet the West Bay I described it yesterday to the guy that called me. I said I have tight relationships, and I have the ability to sell in, and I, you know, act as an agent, and you know, there's a trust factor, and you know, all that goes, you know, a long way. And he says, well, that's trumpeted by my checkbook. And I said, yeah, absolutely. I said, you can go in and start buying up talent. I said, there's nothing to stop you from doing that. I said, you know, that's fine. You can do one-off deals where you go buy talent. But why buy talent when there's already existing relationships and you can, you know, you can build on that. So, it's an interesting time. It is. And I don't know if Discover's buying the talent. Now it'll be curious to see what happens with some of the content on Rev3, because they've already been syndicating into some secondary cable heads. They've actually been going into, there's a startup in Texas, I think, that Callie's show is on. So the question is, will they still be pushing into that small independent cable network, or will she have to be pulled out of that?
Well, also, you know, keep in mind that these worlds are blending together. I mean, if you look at the Discovery Channel, they actually own, you know, some web video properties already. The right. How Stuff Works yeah. brand is with the Discovery Channel, and they're pretty much solely only web podcast streaming kind of distribution, and they're very popular. So really, that could be, I mean, this acquisition of Rev3 to me really means that these big TV networks like the online syndication strategy that Rev3 has. And I think that the talent is definitely part of that. And I think what you're going to see is some of the shows that Discovery wants to create will be created through the production process that's being used by Rev3 that's low cost. Because one of the big challenges that the big studios have is the cost of production of shows. And this is the pressure that the big studios are under right now, is that as you look at web video, it's typically a lower revenue-based piece of content versus broadcast stuff, right? So and there's a lot of things that those big studios could learn from a Rev3 around costs of production and those kind of things. And if they can produce shows at that lower cost point that could also be made available on TV too, which also lowers their costs, which are profit margins. So I think that there's kind of a dual dynamic going on here, that there's lessons that the web video creators can teach the big studios, and there's other things that the big studios can help, you know, the smaller web creators solve too, with, you know, its TV distribution. So it's kind of a synergistic relationship that I think that we're seeing here play out. And it's going to be interesting, because I know that the conversations between those two really centered around, well, we have shows that we would like to distribute through Rev3's distribution platform, and then Rev3 has shows that they would love to get on Discovery distribution. So you can see a real synergy of strategy around content and the distribution side, and I think that's the power of it.
Well, one thing too, that you, without breaking any disclosure agreements, and I can say that, you know, I can sell against How Stuff Works. I can sell against their network. You know, basically bring ad buys to them, but you know, they have a book rate that they get for their shows, and you know, they are they're pretty aggressive in that space. And I appreciate that they are, you know, they've got great content, but, you know, I think they're finding, just like a lot of other folks are finding, that, you know, the digital ad space is still lagging in a big way. It's ridiculous. We're at this point still. And I think we're close to a synergy shift. It's still a struggle for me to fill, all of our inventory. And, it shouldn't be a struggle to fill inventory at this point. We should be able to sell it. But, what it is the media buyers, without disparaging media buyers, everything digital they want at, they want to buy it at banner ad rates. You know, they just want to buy it at absolute rock dirt bottom prices. And you can't sell it that cheap. It just doesn't, it financially doesn't, especially for video. There's the delivery cost. So let's say you have you look at a show like mine. If someone watches my 640 by 360 version, it's 8 cents to deliver that to them. That's just to get it to them. Now, obviously, economies of scale work with companies like Discovery, and it probably would cost them 2 cents. But you break that down, you multiply that by 1,000. And, that's the base CPM rate you've got to get just to break even, on the video delivery. So, and that's not even counting infrastructure cost. So, if you look at 1,000 times, 0.02, my upper level math here, you're talking $20 just to deliver 1,000 episodes or 1,000 views of it.
So I think that there's something unique going on here. If you look at Twit and you look at Rev3, I've been hearing for a long time that they're getting premium CPM rates, anywhere from $50 to $80 a pop.
Well, that's what they'd say.
No, I totally agree with that. That could be, maybe they got one deal in that price range this year, that kind of situation, but it feels like that kind of embedded advertising has a lot more value than the pre-rolls, right?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting play, and I sent Jim an email and I congratulated him, and I hope they do well, and I'm happy to see it. This is for us. It was huge news. It just gives everyone in my company a boost of energy to know that there is a potential exit, and not that I'm looking for an exit, but I'm always willing to talk with someone that has a checkbook with lots of zeros on it.
Todd.
So, that's what what do you do with a business? That's the first thing you do. Anyone that's in business and will lie to you if they're telling you that they're not looking for, looking for a way. Some people say, oh, I'll build a business and I'm in it to, live the rest
change
of my
the
life.
World,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, you're into it to change the world, but most entrepreneurs today are looking for an exit. So, and maybe not to leave the company, but you definitely, get the reward of that hard work.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, Andy, what do you think about the whole Rev3 act?
Well, I was glad to really glad to see that that a lot of that work and a lot of that thought that Jim and those guys had put out was recognized. But I think that whether or not the merits of that, I think, were really kind of subsumed by what was going on in the industry at large. They're obviously sensing that there's a real shift in the way that consumers want to access content, and so a big part of it, I think, is kind of covering their bets and remaining flexible to see, okay, as we move to this two or three screen sort of environment with the importance of smartphones, tablets, etc., it's an unsettled time. And I think there was a certain amount of, yes, you got really attractive ideas. This is really interesting. But the other part of it was, I think we're going to cover our bets here a little bit because we're not sure which way things are going to fall.
And they're one of the few networks that actually has stuff you can actually watch. They they, you know, they put out great, Discovery puts out great stuff. And yeah, I spend time on TLC, on Discovery. You know, there's a handful of channels that we watch since we've reconnected, since my wife reconnected the cable, you know, and they're one of them. You know, my kids, that's, I think there's three Discovery channels that my kids are on all the time. You know, there's 800 other channels of crap. So, you know, they're actually in a great, from a network position, they're one of the few networks that's in a great position to, you know, still have people have the remote control turning into Discovery. So, you know, they're not like, you know, some of these others, you just like, why does this channel even exist?
Yeah, I think if you really back up and you look at just the overall strategy that the Discovery Channel and the Discovery properties have, it's very much, you know, in line with what is going on with the internet and the web. It's very niche. It's very targeted towards certain passion groups out, you know, out there, that it really lends itself to a web strategy as well as a broadcast. And it's really the only major media property that is really, I think, doing a good job in both areas. And I think that this deal really reflects that. Because, you know, let's be honest, Rev 3 is very niche content. It's mainly around tech and science and that kind of stuff, and gaming and those kind of things, which are niche audiences that I'm sure that the Discovery Channel is probably going to offer some sort of a broadcast piece of this as well, that's going to be on their cable channels. But also, as all their content moves to set-top boxes and moves to, you know, more web, you know, to TV type of broadcast models, they're going to be able to offer even more genres of content, and this just adds to their overall selection, I think.
You know, I've got Angela working on a new report. I put a whole bunch of new metrics together, and I'm having him pull our data. I can come to Blog World in next month and come armed with some new data points. So I don't have that in hand yet, but I'm excited to be able to share. We'll probably do it in a press release, because I don't have a dedicated session to talk about that, but maybe I can share some of the numbers with you, Rob, and you can use it in our session that we have together. But you know, just it's interesting to see how things are shifting. But I will say this: I know one thing, and there's some preliminary data. If I was an investor in Boxy, I'd be worried. they're not
doing too good.
No, they're not doing well at all. From our perspective, from what we see in our apps. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't see a bunch of activity around Boxy either right now. I mean, I don't think they're selling any boxes, are they?
Well, they haven't sold very many. That's for sure. In their overall stack.
Yeah.
What's the latest on Google TV 2.0?
No, it's zooming. That's where the growth is. Between them and Roku, they own it right now. Yeah, they own it. Roku still. I just can't believe they haven't been acquired. I'm just wondering when that shoe's going to drop.
So who do you think would acquire them?
ABC, NBC, or CBS?
Oh, really?
You
think a content network would acquire them, not a technology company?
We'll see. You know, these guys have, you know, well, if I would if I was willing to get a foot in the door and be assured that my content at some point is going to be able to be on some device, I don't know. Well, that's my prediction, but what do I know?
Yeah. What's happening in the actual television manufacturer realm? It seemed that we were going to be going through a phase here where each manufacturer is going to have their own exclusive app store and to the exclusion of other pieces of content, and that we would kind of like in the VHS beta days, we'd have to go through a transitional period until all these things battle out towards some sort of common connected TV standard. Do you think that that anyone's being successful with this brand specific app store?
I think what we're going to find in what I saw NAB, I saw a lot of Android TVs.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a lot of Android TVs.
You saw a lot of Android TVs.
Yeah, lots of Android TVs. And, you know, it's just basically same old, same platform as Google TV, just different motif. And then I think that's how it's going to end up washing out. Now, LG, they're coming out with their first Google TV. It's two models, pretty high end, $1,600 and $2,300 each. You know, Samsung is still cranking stuff out. But, you know, every year model that Samsung...
But they're still on a proprietary channel store, yeah, you know, platform there, right?
Yeah, and, you know, we put our channels out thinking we're all good to go. And someone emailed me the other day, said, hey, Todd, I just brought a 2012... Samsung television and you're not there. Where are you at? So I call Samsung and they say, oh, you need to get your app approved for our 2012 models. We'll start the QA process. And I was like, wow. So, you know, not only do you have to build this proprietary software, now every time they release a model, I have to go through a new QA process. And, that is expensive.
Todd, I was just thinking, you know, we're just talking about our Roku, and I'm wondering if a more likely buyer of a Roku box might be somebody like a Comcast.
That could, well, Comcast, I'm going to tell you, Comcast and Time Warners of the world, they're not stupid. They are going to have their own offering. They're going to come out with a new set-top box of their own, and it's going to be, have a cable connection, and it's going to have this alternative menu, and you will pay with all your credit cards to play.
Yeah.
You know,
but that seems like the most likely set-top box scenario that I can think of where, you know, player has a real interest in buying a Roku type of player would be a cable company.
The cable provider's not going to open source nothing.
Yeah.
They're not.
Well, they can also inject their software into that Roku box, right?
Right.
And actually start to control that experience. So
if they bought Roku, if a major television network bought Roku, I think we'd all be worried that we'd get removed.
Yeah. I think that's the reason why a content company isn't going to buy a Roku is because then they wouldn't have a complete offering.
Yeah, it's hard to say, but you know, the cable providers are, you know, how long has it been since your cable box has been updated, Andy?
Don't have one, so I don't know.
Rob,
we're on DirecTV. That box is probably 4 years old, maybe.
Okay, Rob, how long has it been since your cable box has been updated?
I don't know. Honestly, I've had the same type of set-top box for probably close to 10 years now.
10 years. So it's about time for these. And it's about, because I've been looking at this nationwide, you know, the average cable box is 5 to 6 years old. So that tells me they're due for a refresh. Now, if refreshes. Well,
in dog years, in technology dog years, that's time seven.
That's right.
Well, also remember, guys, that most of these set-top boxes are made by Motorola, which is now owned by Google.
Right. Someone was saying in the chat room, apps for each device is where it's at. You know, I encourage anyone that is a content creator to build an app for each device and see how much that's going to set you back in your wallet. Andy, how much you think it's going to cost to You had a Roku app built independently. If you had to build a Google TV, a Samsung, an Android TV, an iPhone, and let's say you had to build five more apps, what's that going to set you back?
Am I buying a car here?
A Volkswagen or a Cadillac XTS? Which one are you buying?
Well, it's not an STS, but it sure isn't a 2004 Taurus either.
That's right. So, yeah, a brand new car for five new apps, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's all good and well to say let's have an app for every device, you know, and, you know, that's what I'm faced with. That's why people are asking me, well, why don't you have this app? Why don't you build, you know, app for every content creator? Well, you know, we probably could, but, you know, it's, I like making money, not losing money. And we have, so we have to be careful on where we put stuff, you know, where we put our resources. So we, you know, we're going to build network apps. We're not going to build individual apps. If someone wants us to build, we'll build an individual app. I have to build a one, and maybe I can buy a new car.
Yeah, I mean, if you really back up and you look at where the use case is, it's not around building an app for one show or one piece of content. It's actually aggregator apps is what actually gets used out there.
Yeah.
So,
and there was a discussion on the some article I saw yesterday, 60% of iPhone app developers never break even.
Yeah.
So if you think about, you know, what is there, 1 million apps out there, and 60% of those folks have not even broken even, and they don't even talk about percentage of profit. You always hear about the ones that do 1 million sales in 3 days. Those are the guys that, you know, those are few and far between.
Yeah, if a few of them are breaking even, there's not a lot of profit to be talked about.
No.
So,
well, we spent a lot.
That's because it's only one component kind of the triad of the way people want to consume content.
Yep.
You know, it comes back to, you know, we talk about the, you know, time, place, and screen of choice. And all of those have to be met.
And, you know, that's difficult, you know, and thank God I'm glad we were ahead we were number 23 Roku app. So, you know, I was pretty happy that, but now there's 400. So, you know, it's an interesting space, but yeah, people want to consume it wherever and whenever. And I think ultimately what it's going to boil down to is they got to be able to get to it from a screen, whether it be from a link, whether it be from a website, you know, as long as they can get to it, that's what counts. If they want to consume it, they're going to get to it. But you know, I was going to say earlier, Friday night here in the Cochran household yesterday, we're normally movie night. So what's going on with my youngest son? He's got the iPad. He's playing Angry Birds. My daughter is on the first gen Mac that's got an Intel chip in it. That's on its last leg. She's watching YouTube. My son is, I think he's reading a book, believe it or not. And then, you know, what is my wife doing? She's on Facebook. And what am I doing? I'm in here writing blog posts. So it's, you know, it's a Friday night and we're not, the television is off. It's not even on.
Huh.
You know, what is that? What is Friday night in most American homes? Movie night. People are watching movies. They're hanging out together. It's, so the family dynamic, and if it's happening here in my household, you know, it's happening everywhere.
Yeah, I think one of the things from a grandparent standpoint is the impact that FaceTime has had in kind of changing the experience. It's like, you know, if you don't get your FaceTime call, you know, sometime in the day or two, you kind of wonder. And that becomes, you know, yet another competition for attention and time.
Yep. Neil was asking, how many theme apps do I really need? I guess, what would a theme app be? A theme app would be the GNC app, or would a theme app be a network app? You know, I think I consider a theme app would be if I wanted to listen to, you know, Curry's show. He's got No Agenda. They've got an app. So I might, because I listen to his show on a regular basis, maybe I'll have his app, but I don't have an app for any Revision 3 stuff. You know, if I want to watch their stuff, I bring it up on my phone. So I think we all have basically we carry on our phones what we love, and that's it.
Yeah, I think if you're going to build an app for a show, let's say like this show has its app, you know, as an app, the only people that are going to download that are going to people that are very passionate about following this show. And that's going to be a subset of people that just, you know, randomly discover it in an aggregator experience,
right,
like a Zune experience. If I put a, a feature for this show up on the front page of the Zoom software, it's going to get found by new people, right? So yeah, that aggregator experience allows people, new people, to find new shows. But these apps are not something that somebody's going to go download and install and stuff like that if they don't have any idea what the show's about or have any connection to the show.
I want to switch topics here a little bit. I've had a run-in with Google.
Uh-oh.
Not in a good way.
Uh-oh.
Google came out with a Panda update called 3.5 on the 19th of April. And I immediately noticed a hit on the traffic at Geek News Central. And I went into Google Webmaster Tools and I looked and had no warnings and trying to figure out exactly why I got penalized by the Google God. And, that's just what we got to call him at this point, is the Google God. And, you know, it was enough of a hit that it got my attention. And the nearest thing that we can figure out is the way I've been doing show notes has hurt me in a big way. Normally, I would do a show and I would list every link to every article that I covered in the show right within the show notes, one after the other. So I think they've hammered me for link density and...
link spam.
Yeah. So even though it was legitimate in the context of the show notes, the Google gods didn't understand it. The computer said, here's a site with great content. They didn't lower my page rank. They did not delist me, but they weren't driving as much traffic to me from Google search engine. Now, the stuff that I'm getting, and I'm still getting a huge amount of traffic from Google, is pages that are ranking 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, basically 1 through 10. I'm getting that type of traffic back to articles. So now I have a new website, and this website is going to be listed on Geek News Central from a perspective of only having a link to it with a no follow. And this site is going to have the repository of all the show notes. Now, I've done the first 25 shows. I've moved the content off the post and cross posted them in. So if you come over to Geek News Central now, and let's see, we covered it. The website, and you load the website up, and we go to the audio feed. I've made a big explanation of what I did, and I've also asked for, this is the only article I haven't moved yet, I asked Google for some relief, and we'll see if they're going to give it to me. I don't know, but now, if you go to one of my show notes, you'll see here, it says everything at the bottom for all the links to the Stories References podcast. Click here. And I have this URL tied to a nofollow. I put a relationship equals nofollow, so I don't want Google going to this page. And it takes me to the show notes, the show number 759. So this really sucks. And like, oh man, squeal, my listeners have just lost their minds. So essentially what I have to do now in order to get back in the good grace of the Google gods is I have to go through 762 episodes and move that content over to the new website.
So what are you accomplishing by moving it over to the site? That's what I'm curious.
I'm getting the links off geeknewcentral.com.
The link density, goes down.
Yeah. I'm removing the link density.
So I would say just based, I've been doing, I did search engine optimization as a kind of a consultant for many years. And I think it's the format of how you're showing your show notes. You probably need to add more text, around the links. Well, and they probably wouldn't penalize you.
Well, the challenge is that they still have link density. So here on my last show, there's 32 links in a single blog post. It doesn't matter if I put all the words in the world, I could make this a 15 paragraph article. There's still 32 links in there, and according to the Google gods and their SEO, that is unacceptable link density.
Yeah, because you're only linking to every text.
I'm linking to every article
in there, right? So you're hyperlinking all of the text that's listed there. Right?
Essentially, yep.
Yeah, pretty much every character that's there.
So if you were to just type that same title of that and then put a just like a click here or something like that.
Don't think it'll make a difference at this
really?
Point.
Really? Okay, yeah. You don't think it would make a difference? Mm-mm.
I'm not willing to risk the experiment. Now it's, you know, my goal is to get out of jail as fast as I can. Mm-hmm. And
how were you notified, Todd?
I wasn't notified. I looked at my stats.
That's the whole problem.
Yeah, and there's no warning in my webmaster tools. And I went through and everything in webmaster tools says you're doing, and here's the deal on 3.5. It's not a... It's an algorithm change. It's not a penalty change. In other words, this is something permanent. It's not a, you have to fix it on your website. There's no, I don't think even if I've asked for relief, they will give me relief. Just based on their criteria. Another thing they have is the page loading speeds. You know, they're looking at that and they're not sending you as much traffic based on your page speed. So now I'm going into making sure that we're going to have to start putting graphics on CDNs and stuff like that. We haven't done that in the past. You know, it's been served from the server, but they expect a page to load in 1.5 to 2 seconds. So,
Wow.
But, there's 10,000 articles on Geek News Central. We get a great, actually almost 11,000 now. So we've got a great history. All the content's largely original. And really the only content that I can figure has hurt me is the show notes. It's the only thing, because we've always done well and we're still doing well, but it's, you know, there was enough of a drop that, and I played by the rules. All my sponsor leaks have no follows in them. You know, I do what I'm supposed to do and basically tell Google, don't check this, you know, and I've been real good about it. But it is one of those things. And there's a lot of people that have gotten hurt, and not just from link density either, but there's been three sets of rules rolled out. They had another change last night. And I actually have seen today, I'm seeing an increase by, just from the change last night, a 20% increase in traffic today. I'm getting some traffic back, but not until, and once I get all these show notes moved, then I'll wait 2 months and we'll see what happens. Because it'll take probably 2 months for it to recover.
So what kind of activity are you seeing around Bing? I'm just curious.
Bing's driving me decent traffic. It's, let me look. Let's see where it's at in the stack. Actually, wrong folder here.
So you're not seeing them penalize you the same way Google is density thing.
Be honest with you, I've never really tracked Bing that much. Let me see here. Search engine. Recent page load. Browsers. No. Where's? Oh, search engine wars. There we go. Bing is right now 11% of my traffic. Now Google, here's the interesting part. Google used to be 85% of my traffic, or 85% of my search engine traffic. Now it's 62. So that tells you how much it dropped.
Mm-hmm.
So
where does it shift to? Facebook?
It doesn't shift. It just increases the other, you know, I just lost, 23% or whatever it was of my Google traffic. I just simply, it just vanished, and Bing and the rest of them continue to, their percentages increased, but the, and believe it or not, I get a lot of traffic from Naver, NAVER.com. I don't know how I end up on there. They actually drive me more traffic than Bing does. And Naver is not even an American website. It's Chinese.
Oh, I see.
Which is weird. I don't know.
That's a huge population pool to pull from.
Yeah. So it's either Korean. I don't know if it's Chinese. I'm looking at the characters. It might not even be Chinese. It might be, what does that look like? Is there an about page? NHN Corporation. Where's NHN Corp?
Would that be Hong Kong?
Yeah, Hong Kong, maybe.
Or Taiwan?
Yeah. Those
Korean characters.
Yeah, it's Korean.
Right,
it might
at
be
the top.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Yeah. So I don't Naver. I think it might be Korean.
Yeah,
it's not Chinese.
That's a Hangul there.
Yeah.
Korean.
So you know, and they drive 15% of my traffic, search engine traffic. So that's you know, Bing is 11, Yahoo's 9.6, Ask Jeeves is like 0.2, you know.
Well, if you look at Yahoo, that's actually Bing. So you really should take the Yahoo number plus the Bing number and combine them, and that tells you
so
what
that's
the Bing
20%.
Number is. Yeah. You take all you can get, right?
That's right. But you know, one thing that is kind of interesting is the hang time. Since this Google change has happened, the hang time on my website has changed dramatically. Actually, it's better. Let me look at visit length. So right now, the visit length is, I used to run, you'd lose about 90% of your traffic would hit and go, you know, it'd be like, and they'd be on for less than a minute. So my hang time on the website has actually changed dramatically. People that visit the site, 7% stay longer than an hour, which makes sense because those are people coming in probably watching a show. And then there's an additional 25% or so that stay more than 5 minutes. So my actual hang time on the website since this, so it's actually, you know, it's two different things. I lost the Google traffic, but also the more focused traffic is coming to the website now, and it's caused my pie to shift. So it actually shows that people are staying on the website longer, less traffic, but they're staying longer on a whole. And I'm sure that's just because we're getting less Google traffic. So, you know, that pie just changed because of it.
Well, yeah. And if you look at your content, most of your content is longer form type content, longer articles, long shows, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I would expect that, you know, a lot of your traffic would be there for long periods of time.
Yep. So, anyway, that Google gods are not fair sometimes. This is only the second time in 10 years I've had a impact from Google. So, the first time I knew what it was, made changes, and it resolved itself. And hopefully this time it'll resolve itself. Maybe it won't. For my writer's sake, I hope it does. Because if the traffic doesn't come back, I'm going to have to cut down on the number of writers, which would suck. But we'll give it some time and see how it wades out. Well, let me flip back here to an interesting article that was up on CNET last night. And we're actually pretty long already. I probably need to wrap up. But the FBI said, we need wiretap-ready websites now.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
The FBI is asking internet companies not to oppose a controversial proposal that would require firms, including Microsoft, Facebook, Yahoo, and Google, to build in backdoors for government surveillance.
Oh, I see. Interesting. They want to be able to peek into our worlds here, you know. So when we're doing this show on Skype, they can do keyword density searches on us.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, I think the way things are right now, you can just be about guaranteed. Anything you say, do, or think about doing on the internet is being recorded. I just can't imagine the way this digital world is since 9/11. It's
or it's being scanned be probably a better way of saying it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if certain words are used, then that maybe triggers a recording. Who knows?
Who knows? Or that maybe the recording that was already made on you is reviewed. You know, who knows how?
Yeah, it could be that way too. You're right. Be careful what you say.
Yeah, that's a fact.
Yeah, I'm just thinking back to this has probably been 10 years ago, or certainly 6-7 years ago, where certain activists in their signature block would put all of these sure to trip them code word or keywords. Right. Just to make sure that that they were being read, and you know, they'd say hello.
Yeah.
So you're gonna ask you guys for a prediction here. Facebook is obviously getting ready to do their IPO. They're going to set their initial price range from $28 to $35. Zuckerberg has got to put 30 million shares on the line just to pay his tax bill with the IPO. Can you imagine that? And he's only got 67.6 million shares total. So 28 to 35. My prediction is that this thing is going to go over 50, 55, 60 before it's all over. What do you guys think that, where do you guys think the share price is going to come in when it gets on the market?
I think it'll spike up the day of the IPO, and then over a subsequent week or so, it's going to tail off back down to probably 30 or 40 bucks is my guess. So it'll go up to 60, 70, who knows? You know, it could go up pretty high pretty quick because it's going to be hot right at the beginning, but then it's going to settle back down.
It's going to lose 20% at least in the next week just from people cashing out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to fall. So if you're not getting the initial IPO price, I would wait to buy the stock.
Yeah. I think this is going to be the hottest thing going. I think I think these guys are going to raise an insane amount of money. They're going to be one of the biggest ones on the stock market once it's introduced.
So I think it's a good question to ask here at this point about Facebook. Do we think that Facebook is a viable business model on the scale of an Apple or a Microsoft or a Google that could drive a valuation in the 200 to 300 billion range? Is that what this company's potential is? I think a lot of people are asking that question right now. Is the revenue opportunities for this company substantial enough to drive a high valuation, or is this company kind of a little bit of a flash in the pan? I think it's a valid question.
If you've got 800 billion or 600 billion, however many 800 million products to sell, because you're selling the information of every person that's there.
That's right.
That's a part of the ecosystem. It looks to me like it'd take you a while to go through and test the value of each one of those.
So the question I always ask is, Rob, you were on Facebook yesterday, right?
Yep.
How about you, Andy?
Yep.
Okay. So did you click any ads while you're on Facebook?
Nope.
Do you ever remember clicking an ad in Facebook?
Nope.
How are they making any money?
Exactly. That's really my fundamental point is, does this company scale beyond where they're at now, or have they basically peaked because they've already attained almost a billion users and they haven't really scaled to the revenue volume of a Google or Apple or Microsoft?
On the other hand, did you play any farm games yesterday?
No.
You know any family members that play any farm games?
Not farm games, but Words with Friends. Man, there's 6 or 8 of those going on in my household at any time.
But are those owned by Google? I mean, owned by Facebook?
Aren't they? No, those are Zynga properties, I think.
Huh. I think the real value is in Zynga and those other folks.
Yeah, so it begs the question, what can Facebook throw into the mix here that can make them a high revenue play? I mean, do they have to be more like a Google, or do they need to be more like an Apple?
They have to be more like a Google, obviously. You know,
which means that they're going to have to get in the search business.
Well, are they not? Have you done any searches on Facebook?
No,
I search for people sometimes.
Yeah, but they haven't really deployed anything either.
No. But did you use Instagram?
No, because they didn't make an app for Windows Phone. So.
Oh, well, that's probably a good reason. My daughter uses it all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll have to see. We'll have to see how this all shakes out for sure. But
So I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, this is going to be a hot stock, right? It's going to ramp up and get real high real fast. But I just wonder if the reality of this this business that isn't there is going to start to become clearer, and that stock's going to come back down again.
True. The on a different topic, the AT&T, one of their chief operating, what is he? He's a chief executive. They don't say his exact title. His name's Randall Stephenson. He's made some pretty outrageous. This guy's a guy that's completely out of touch what's going on with the real world too. But because I've heard some of the stuff this guy has said before, but he shared some surprisingly frank comments about the iPhone. In particular, he said that he wished the company had never offered an unlimited data plan for the device, and that he loses sleep over free texting services like Apple's iMessage. He says if AT&T hadn't offered unlimited data, it would have been able to get people who used more data to pay up front for it, as opposed to having the light data users subsidize the heavy ones. He says we should have been charging by the megabyte from the very beginning. Is this another company that still is, you know, obviously they're one of three. They didn't get T-Mobile. It's all about the bandwidth, isn't it?
Yeah, that's their currency.
He says you lay awake every night worrying.
What to say about that.
He says you lie awake at night worrying about what it is that will disrupt your business model. He said, Apple iMessage is a classic example. If you're using iMessage, you're not using one of our messaging services, right? That's disruptive to our messaging revenue stream, of course, because they earn a huge. It's just pure profit. It's like, what is their overhead to run that? Nothing. So it's just pure cash.
And they were overhead bits to begin with.
Right.
Yeah.
So
I sure hope that the engineer who actually did that and actually proposed SMS. I sure hope he got a nice, healthy retirement bonus or at least a nice watch when he left.
Well, you know, knowing AT&T, he probably was gotten rid of during some merger or when they split him up or something.
Yeah.
He's one of those guys that was ripped out. But
you know, Todd, there's one article I wanted to bring to your attention. It was on ZDNet. The last CES.
Oh, really?
Yes. Gadget fatigue. They said, what happened to PC Expo, 1983 to 2002? What happened to Comdex, 1972 to 2003? More of the same stuff. And we felt a little bit of that fatigue settling in just this past year. I think he's... He puts a stake in the ground. He says 2016 is when he figures that it's going to be the last CES. What do you think?
Oh, that's an awful big show to go away in 4 years.
Also, is the writer.
Yeah, it's also a valid question is what would replace it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been looking at, you know, trying to think of a strategy for 13 that would be a little different. Not so labor intensive on the post show end. I don't know. You know, there was definitely no. Well, what it is we've gotten into a release cycle where CES is not the place where people always release gadgets. You know, so it used to be a place where there was 100 new announcements of 100 new gadgets. And what did we have last year? We had a handful, maybe.
Mm-hmm. So does this just mean that the whole concept of a gadget show kind of goes away?
Well, I think just the gadget shows are now being done on Ustream. You know, they're announcing products on their own. They're using social media streams to announce new gadgets. They're sending bloggers that are willing to sell their souls for a $5 gadget. They're sending them a free gadget and letting them do a review on it.
But also, I think one of the core reasons that CES is in decline is because of the timing of the event. So I wonder if what the solution for them would be is to hold this event more in, let's say, a August or September timeframe, where these companies that want to announce new gadgets for the holidays can actually do that.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Now, the question, though, is what competes with that? And
vacations.
Yeah. I don't know. Andy, what do you think?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting, and of course, trade shows in general under tremendous challenge, you know, again, from a cost effectiveness standpoint, from the standpoint of the manufacturer. I wonder how long I wonder if the current timing isn't tied in with the whole supply chain, and that I think of some, an outfit like Pogo Plug, which announced at CES several years ago. And, you know, they got some prototypes. They've got 60 days to get those first things in the hands of reviewers. You know, it gives them 3 or 4 months to kind of ascertain how much, you know, is this thing going to get any traction before they have to commit to a supply chain and then have them available for the following Christmas season. I mean, it may well be.
That's true.
That the January timeframe is selected simply because of the logistics required to get the design shaken out, the volume production supply chain in order, actually get them built in August, September, and then October to get them into the channel. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. I think also, I mean, it raises the topic that maybe there needs to be two shows. Maybe there needs to be a show that's just for the industry from a retail and manufacturer. I think that CES has become kind of a external consumer show, and that's not the right time of the year for an external consumer show.
Now
be great timing for the trade, right?
They do have a summer show in New York. I've never went to that, and I don't know, you know, what the makeup is and the companies that are there, but they do have a summer show, and maybe I'll go to that one time. Hey, we should talk just a little bit. I don't know. I don't know where it's going to go, Andy, for CES, but let's talk just a little bit about the decision by Blogworld. First of all, let's talk about Blogworld New York. Let's make this the last topic for today because we're already hour 30. Let's talk about Blogworld New York, and what do you think, Rob? How do you think the show is going to be?
I think it'll be a kind of a transitionary show. I think it'll be probably okay as far as the attendance. Though I have to say it's pretty expensive to go to this thing. It may be kind of just an average kind of attendance is kind of my thinking at this point. And then, but I think when it goes back to Las Vegas, I think there's a chance that there could be kind of a renewed, you know, kind of enthusiasm around the show, you know, with the new name and kind of the new focus.
Have they announced the new name yet? Or are they going to announce the new name in New York?
They're going to announce it in New York, yeah.
So, you know, I talked to Rick about this. He confided in me before they made the announcement of that they were going to make a name change. And I also knew about the Vegas switch. I even knew about the dates for the Vegas switch, but you know, I am still torn on the dates they picked for the Vegas show to happen 2 days before CES and actually have 1 day of overlapping during CES. So we're talking, you know, that's just, you know, people just coming off Christmas vacation. Normally that week of the week of the 14th is, you know, people go back to work on the 7th of January. How do you ask the boss for, you know, 3 more days off right after the holiday to Blogworld?
Yeah, it's also a long time to stay in Vegas too, right?
Well, you know, I think CES this year is the 15th through the 18th, And I think he plans on having the show. Oh gosh, what was the date?
Yeah, I think it's just prior to that.
Yeah, so it's kind of a weird. It's a Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, or something like that is the show date. So let's look here. Blog World. Oh, that's dumb. Blog World. Let's see if they've actually got the dates on for January, if they actually posted them. They're pushing everything for the June show. But, you know, I don't know. What do you think, Andy, right there before CES for Blog World?
I think it's going to be a push up. I'm very glad to see them come back to Las Vegas because of the facilities and the ability to get in and out of there. I have no plans for New York or LA, particularly New York with the cost involved there. So I'm very glad to see it back in Las Vegas. As far as the time is concerned, I think that people involved in the trade or involved, professionally, one situation, but pretty rough for the average or the beginning blogger to make that happen.
Yeah, I agree. And well, that's interesting. I mean, it's on the Blog World site, and my picture's not up on their page yet. So, yeah, that's one thing that kind of bothers me about Blog World. If Rick doesn't give the podcasting space equal play, equal keynotes at the next event, then, you know, I don't know what else can be said.
Well, that was one of the reasons that I didn't invest in the LA event was as you looked at the sessions that were there. It was very, very small percentage of the activity was in any way related to podcasting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it wasn't promoted at all, and it was really kind of buried in the back rooms of the event. It was very, very lacking in focus around it. Yeah.
You know, I worked on a presentation for that. That's why I didn't submit this year. I did not submit for my own session and for New York. I did all the work and went and, 20 people were in the room. You know, I'm like, I can do 20 people on a live event or I can, do it on a show and why did I waste my time 3 hours putting a presentation together? And I'm sure the 20 people appreciated it, but it was horrible.
Yeah, I guess this year they're pushing a lot harder on the virtual attendance stuff, where a person can buy all the audio and slide presentations and things like that, so they don't actually have to go. They can actually get access to all of the sessions, without actually having to be there. So that's one other way that they're trying to reach out, and I've been hearing more and more about that strategy on their part as well to reach people that can't actually attend.
And I know Cliff is, I'm glad Cliff is running the podcast part. I think he's the right guy for the job on that. It's still, this is, you look at the front page of the website right now, it is blogger, 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 blogger. There is no, I see Cliff as one guy that's on the front page. But I don't see anyone else that still is, blogger, blogger, journalist, blogger, 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 designer, managing editor, blogger. There's where still, even today, after they said that they were going to be taking care and making sure that we had the media creators on there, where the hell are they? It's still, even right now, so it pisses me off even more. I don't know. He's going to have to really do something big. And of course, all the, it's the same name, same faces that we see again and again and again.
Yeah, that's true.
So we will see. Not that I'm, and Rick knows, my whole thought process on this. So if we don't get equal billing, time will tell. Andy, any last thoughts?
Oh, I'm just looking at the list of characters. Lots of familiar names, familiar speakers, and I'm not sure, you know, that there's a lot of additional insights vis-a-vis what we've seen before.
Yeah. Well, the proof will be in the pudding, won't it, Rob, when we get there?
Oh, yeah.
At $300 a night for a hotel room.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not cheap to go to this thing, that's for sure.
And it's in the middle of the week again.
Yeah, and I wouldn't go if I, you know, wasn't a speaker.
You know, and it's, so, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And I'm like, come on. Let's have this on a Wednesday, a Thursday, Friday, Saturday. You know, have it where at least people that are, you know, can come and so, you know, what you do is you tell the wife, hey, well, honey, you want to go to New York? You know, Saturday, I'm going to kind of go to this Blog World thing for a couple of hours. And then Sunday, we go to, the, you know, Saturday night, we go to the theater. We can do this and, you know, we can hang out in the city. We can make it maybe, you know, a nice little weekend, do a little business, do a little pleasure. But no, if you're coming from the West Coast, you have to leave Monday night, get there Tuesday,
yep.
You know, Wednesday, Thursday, then you fly back. So you got to take 4 days off of work. And Rick says, well,
it's the whole week, pretty much.
It's the whole week. So Rob, you know, Rick says, well, this is for the, you know, this is for business people. Well, bloggers, most podcasters are not business people, you know?
No.
They have a day job. So can you, you know, you're asking a person to take 24 to 32 hours off of work to go to Blog World?
Plus pay probably, you know, $1,000
for a hotel room and food and everything else.
Yeah.
You know, does he understand, does he still understand the audience? And I've made this point and they just don't, they say, well, the business people don't want to work on Saturdays. Well, if there's going to be an audience there, we're going to want to be there on Saturday.
What's happening in the PodCamp space? Is that still active?
I haven't heard of very many PodCamps.
Yeah, I think that there's a few that are active around the country, but if you actually go to them, and I've gone to a few of them here over the last few years, that they don't really focus on podcasting anymore.
Right.
It's kind of like a bar camp kind of thing is what they turn into.
Mm-hmm.
It's the unconference concept, right, where people come in and sign up to share their new app or some new kind of concept.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, well, guys, we're really long, obviously. So let's get out of here. And I'm getting light shining in my face too. I keep backing up. That sun keeps moving inching by inching. But thanks for hanging out here with me today. And lots of breadth of topics and had some fun sharing some new stuff and bashing some old stuff.
There you go.
So, Andy, I hope everything's going good with you, and we'll catch up. We haven't talked in a while, so you have to call me offline sometime.
Yeah, we'll have to get caught up on that as well.
All right, everybody, thanks for hanging out with me today. The stream will be up for a few more minutes, but for everyone else, take care, and we'll see you next time.